Welcome back as we continue our journey through the human body, and we're looking at the importance of salt and water. We've looked at the types of salts and the different types of salts, and we've looked at why they are good and why they are not good. We've also been looking at water and how the body uses it. And I did mention this yesterday, I'll mention it again, and I think you will remember this, that the hydrochloric acid is made in the liver, and it needs 2 cups of water yesterday to make enough for breakfast this morning, 2 cups of water yesterday to make enough for lunch. Now that's just for your hydrochloric acid. It's a very misunderstood digestive enzyme, is the hydrochloric acid. So just as water dilutes it when we drink with our meals, we also very much need it for even the production of hydrochloric acid. So we've looked at what happens in the stomach. Dr. Batman Gehaldige, Dr. B, said in his book, One of the Body's Many Cries for Water, that when a person's chronically dehydration, they start to make too much saliva. Isn't that interesting? And one man said to me, well, my body is adapted quite well to my dehydration. As you can see, at a cost. Let's start at the top of the head. Your head from the neck up is 85% water. From the neck down, it's 75% water. And your cells, around them is your brain cells, is fluid. Now, on Saturday morning, when I talked about the brain's cleaning process, I also talked about in another lecture on sleep how at night the cells shrink a little bit to allow more fluid around the cells to be able to cleanse. Remember the lymphatic system? There's a cleaning system that happens every night. Now, just as we would not be able to wash the dishes from this morning's breakfast in 1 cup of water. Those dishes would not be clean, and it's the same with the body, especially the brain. It must have water. So it must have water for the cleaning process. And if the brain cells are dehydrated, they can tend to shrink, and the fluid around them is not as much, and that starts to hurt. So some people will find that their headaches are due to dehydration. It's not the only cause of a headache, but it certainly is one of the symptoms. I remember my husband rang me once. He was in the car travelling, and it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and he said, I don't know why, but he said, I've got the most terrible migraine. And he doesn't get migraines. So my first response always is, have you been drinking water? And he went, oh, no. He said, I had water when I woke up, but I didn't have any water between breakfast and lunch. Mm-hmm. And now it's 3 in the afternoon, and I said, aha, must be one of the body's many cries for water. So I encouraged him to have half a glass, and then 5 minutes later, another half glass. And then he said within half an hour, the migraine had gone to a headache. And then keeping drinking with the other half hour, the headache had totally gone. It's nice when it's that simple, and it is not always that simple. But it's one of the first things I look at is hydration. Around the joints. You had a question?
Yeah, when you start with half a glass, because it's too much at once, really?
Yes, it is too much all at once. That's why the illustration of a lot of water into a dry plant.
Yeah,
you want it in little by little by little. And what I also find is people who don't drink water, they are daunted, or do you know the word daunted? They hesitate at a whole glass of water, so they don't drink water. So that's why it's important to come in and show them how, and have little by little by little. One lady said to me, I don't drink water in the morning because it makes me feel sick. I said, oh, and what are you going to do now? Investigate, put the detective hat on. I said, so tell me when you drink water when you get up. Well, as soon as I get up, I go straight to the kitchen and I fill up a 500ml glass and I drink the whole lot down at once. I said, yeah, I'd feel sick if I did that. I said, just do a little bit. But a lot of people have the mentality like my husband, I just want to conquer it and move on.
No.
So you just have it near you and you just keep sipping, just keep sipping, just keep sipping. Have it in the car, have it in by your bed. Have it in the kitchen, and if you're in the workshop, have it in the workshop. If you're in the garden, have it in the garden. Just have it there, and little by little by little. I fly a lot, and it's very important that I drink little by little, because it's not always easy to get out and go to the toilet. And I find if I just sip, it's usually a mouthful at a time, then often... I only have to go when I'm in airports between. Obviously, the 14-hour flight is a bit different, but I always get Michael to get me an aisle seat so that I can frequent, and I'm very excited when the toilet is nearby, because one way to cope with a lot of flying is to keep very well hydrated. So that's an important point. And you can even do an experiment on yourself and have a mouthful of water every 5 minutes, all through the day, of course, stopping before lunch and starting again after, and just document how much water you get in a day. You might find you're getting more water in than when you were drinking large amounts. So it's even a good experiment. And say to your clients or guests that come to the retreat, you know, I did an experiment on myself one day. And I drank a mouthful of water every 5 minutes. And do you know how much water I drank that day? And just document that. Obviously, you'd have to be somewhere where you could have a mouthful of water every 5 minutes. Around the joints is synovial fluid. And I can open and shut my hand quite easily without any pain because there's fluid around my joints. But in dehydration, the body goes into a form of drought management. And what it does is it sees the drought and it looks at where it can take water from. And the first place it'll take it, we looked at that, is the lining of the stomach, but it needs more because it's got to keep up full blood volume. So another place it'll take it is from around the joints. So when you're looking at someone with arthritis, always check how the water is. I might have mentioned that my mother died at 51, a cripple in a wheelchair with rheumatoid arthritis. My mother didn't drink any water, maybe one glass on a hot summer day, but she drank lots of cups of tea. So I believe now, looking back at my mum, I didn't know much, I was only 25 at the time, but I know a lot now, and I look back and assess what happened with mum. And mum did not know. She did not know how important water it was. And she did not realise how dehydrating her cups of tea were. So I think it was a big contributing factor to her arthritis was her chronic dehydration, because the water is taken away from the joints. 75% of upper body weight is held in your lower back by water.
Once again, please.
75% of your upper body weight is held in your lower back by water. So another cause of lower back pain. How many people suffer from lower back pain? And again, there can be a few causes. One is they bend like that instead of like that and use their thighs. So that can be one cause, is just straining the back. But another cause can be dehydration. So my husband has a friend and he lives down in the bottom of Australia, and he's a bricklayer. We call him a brickie. Do you call them that in Sweden? He's a bricklayer, you know, laying bricks. And he was talking to Michael one day, and he said, all the guys on the job site and myself, we've just got these terrible lower back pain. And Michael said, what do you drink? He said, oh, we all drink Coke. We go out in the morning with bottles and bottles of Coke. And Michael said, I've got a challenge for you, mate. Stop the Coke and start drinking water. And he said, oh, as if that would make a difference. There's plenty of water in the Coca-Cola. And you'll find people will say that. So your answer can be that is true. But Coca-Cola has dehydrating agents in it. the caffeine, the sugar, the phosphoric acid, they're all dehydrating agents. And Michael said, just try it, mate. You got nothing to lose. So they did. And after 3 days, he rang up Michael and he said, none of us have got lower back pain. All because they stopped drinking Coke and they started drinking water. Your lungs. In your lungs, you have approximately 300 million alveoli. So, here's a lung, very primitive looking lung. The trachea splits and comes down and then splits more and more and more. It's like the branches of a tree. So it comes down smaller and smaller, 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 smaller. At the end of every bronchial, there's a, looks like a little bunch of grapes, so I'll magnify it for you, and it's the alveoli. And the alveoli is where the gaseous exchange takes place. So we've got about 300 million. It is estimated with every cigarette smoked, one alveoli explodes. And when 2/3 of the alveoli are destroyed, that person has emphysema. Once that alveoli is destroyed, it can never regrow. Over the alveoli is a capillary network. So when we breathe in, all the alveoli fill up with the air, and there's a gaseous exchange. The oxygen is picked up and the carbon dioxide is dumped into the blood, and then we breathe out the carbon dioxide. It's an amazing process, isn't it? Inside every alveoli, there's a minuscule droplet of water. And because of the surface tension of water, you understand surface tension? We were down by the lake the other day, and Sandra said, what's that on the water? And there was a little spider or a little creature, almost like an oversized mosquito, walking on the water. You've seen that, the little creatures that walk on the water. They are able to do that because of the surface tension of water. And because of the surface tension of water, when that droplet of water is in the alveoli, when we breathe out, that alveoli collapses. Which means when you breathe in, you can breathe in your full quota of oxygen. If a person's dehydrated and maybe in many alveoli they don't have the water or they don't have enough, then the alveoli can't totally collapse, so that when we breathe in the next quota of air, we don't get as much. So when you're well hydrated and your alveoli has that moisture there, you're getting more oxygen. Oxygen, the most vital element needed for life. We need to be well hydrated to be able to get our full quota of oxygen. So let's move down the gastrointestinal tract and we come to the pancreas. Pancreas lives under your left rib. Your liver's under your right rib. And the pancreas releases, and we looked at this yesterday, it releases hormones. The hormones are over here. It releases hormones into the blood. And the two hormones it releases into the blood are insulin and glucagon. And these are the two hormones that are required to balance blood glucose levels. So insulin gets the blood glucose levels down, and glucagon gets the blood glucose levels up again. They're both made from water. So if a person's dehydrated, can you see that can be a contributing factor to their diabetes? So these two hormones are released into the blood, but there are enzymes that are released into the gut. We looked at them yesterday. There are enzymes to break down starch, there are enzymes to break down fats, and there are enzymes to break down protein. And we also looked at the fact that it also makes sodium bicarbonate. And the sodium bicarbonate is released to neutralize the stomach acid as it comes down the out of the stomach and into the duodenum. All of these enzymes need water to be made. So when a person's dehydrated, it not only can affect their body's ability to manage blood glucose levels, but it can also compromise digestion. So let's move down and we come to the colon. We looked at the colon yesterday. Here's the colon. And then the last part of the colon. One of the main functions of the colon is to take water out so stools are formed. So in a state of dehydration, more water gets taken out than should be taken out. So dehydration can be a contributing factor to constipation. So that's why I always say to the person, how much water do you drink a day? And get them to tell you exactly how much water they drink through the day. And sometimes guests say, oh, not much. So then I say, would that be 2 or 3 glasses? So I'm pumping them to get the info. Oh, sometimes. Would it be a litre? No, not that much. So then you write that down. And that's very important because through the week when they're with you, you can encourage them and say, how are you going? Always smile very, very much. Have you been able to keep up your water? No, I'm really struggling with that one. Really? Have you tried taking a glass to bed with you? Do you have it when you wake up? See that? Investigate a little bit. And I think I mentioned earlier in the week, there was one lady, she said, I drink quite a lot of water in my cups of tea. Now, the herbal teas are almost equal. So definitely the herbal teas are nearly there. They don't have any dehydrating agents. The dehydrating agents are tannin and caffeine and sugar. They are all dehydrating agents. So definitely, and I know some little ladies who are a little underweight, they find it very hard to drink cold water. So you can suggest warm water. You can suggest a little bit of lemon in the water. But a lot of people, when they start doing the salt, after you've had salt, you usually want water, yes?
Yes. Can you please spell Olivia, which is killed by cigarettes?
Sorry, say that again.
You said about cigarettes, they kill alveoli.
Yeah. I thought you said alvira. Yeah, we talked about that one today. And that's an important piece of information, how the cigarettes kill the alveoli. And I was reading a report of these American doctors that had done a report on the effect of cigarettes on the alveoli. And they explained how, and I'll show you this in detail. In fact, I'll draw it a little bit more. So the 4,000 or so, they claim even more today, chemicals that are in the cigarettes, they're toxic. The nicotine is toxic. And what it does, usually you've got little fibres here. And I'm sure we all have experienced that. You know, if we've eaten something or drank something, what do we say? It's gone down the wrong way. Because when you swallow, you close your trachea and open your esophagus. But sometimes we might be talking too much or laughing and something goes down here and you cough and you cough and you cough. We're going to get it up and out of there. And I know sometimes in the morning, if I'm running up and down hills, I'll feel to cough and I'll cough up a lump from my lungs. And I'll think, praise God. Because when you're flying, you're not always breathing in the best thing. And what happens is these little hairs, they catch things. catch things, and then eventually you cough it up. I also find that with oil pulling. If I've been oil pulling, sometimes I'll cough something up. And what happens with the cigarette when you're smoking cigarettes is the nicotine, and you've probably seen photos of this. I've seen photos in some magazines as turning people off the cigarettes, is especially that nicotine and that tar, it's sort of all the little fibres lay down flat. They're almost glued down. But something else is happening, and that is because of the toxins coming down here that are irritating to the fine lining, then mucus is produced. Mucus? So can you see what's happening here now? That the airways are getting narrower. Mm-hmm. And so the person's breathing in the oxygen, they're breathing out the carbon dioxide, but this guy here, he can't get rid of all his carbon dioxide. So it's still fairly full. And then the person breathes in, and the overload of these gases, it explodes. So that's basically how the alveoli die. When they're dead, they cannot regrow. But you can strengthen what remains. So what is encouraging to tell the smoker is that as soon as you stop smoking a cigarette, and I can't tell you how long it'll take, but when they stop smoking a cigarette, and ideally our health retreats are way out in the country in the beautiful fresh air, then the mucus is no longer necessary to be produced there, and these little fibres start growing again. So when I say that alveoli cannot regrow, but the little fibres, they start to regrow. It's not surprising that a smoker may be coughing up lumps for even a couple of years after they stop smoking. That's not unusual, because there's a lot of cleaning up to do down there. And remember, I've greatly magnified this. So there's the lungs there. You've got 300 million of these, and you've got all these little bronchioles. Magnified, they're all like that. So the lungs need to be looked after. Also, let's look at the urinary system. Your urine should almost be the colour of water. So when a person is dehydrated and their urine gets very strong, that can harm all the little, remember those little, you've got 1 million in each kidney, one, and your kidney's as big as your fist, all of those little filtering units. The more toxic and the more acidic and concentrated is the urine, the more it harms those little filtering units. I'll give you a story to illustrate. We had when I was working in the Bronx a few years ago now, they brought a man to me who was about to go on dialysis, but he could not go on dialysis. So this is 2004, so there was no Obamacare then. So in 2004, if you did not have health insurance and you had a problem, the doctors would not see you. If you couldn't pay, they basically sent him home. So I went and saw him, and his legs were huge. Now, I'm sure you remember when I talked about how those little filtering units, they manage pH, they manage sodium and water levels and blood pressure. So his blood pressure's up, his legs are huge, his kidneys aren't working very well at all. So I said to him, because he was only, 45, I said to him, have you always lived in the Bronx? No, I've only lived in the Bronx the last 12 years. I said, where did you live before? He said, Jamaica. What did you do in Jamaica? I was a market gardener. What did you drink in Jamaica? Oh, I just drank water out on the land. I said, so when you came to the Bronx, did you still drink water? He said, no. Now, when I was in the Bronx, I turned the tap on one day and brown water came out. So the house that I was staying in the Bronx with this family, they have huge big containers of water to cook in, and they have smaller bottles of water, and that's what we drink. The only water we used in the house was to wash our bodies and to wash the dishes. And no house in the Bronx has a laundry. They go to big laundromats with 50 washing machines and 50 dryers, and they have huge big television screens in the laundromat for all the people are sitting there waiting for their washing to happen. I found that intriguing. So I said to him, so when you came to the Bronx, what did you start drinking? He said, oh, soda pop. So what do you call it here? You know, the fizzy drinks? Soft drinks. So he goes in to buy something to drink. There's water, but oh, here's something far more exciting. And if you taste water, it really has no flavour. And if you taste the soda pops, oh, it tastes much nicer. So he went from a market gardener drinking lots of water and came to the Bronx and started drinking just the soda pops, the soft drinks. Can you see what happened to his kidneys? Oh, his kidneys basically just stopped functioning because they had no water. It was a very sad case. I don't know if he survived, because at that stage, if you didn't have care or you didn't have the money, you weren't seen by the doctor. What could I do? Not very much. Not very much at all. One lady told me that she had a friend who came off dialysis by drinking the coconut water. Remember the coconut water we talked about in that green coconut? Very, very high in minerals. But I have not had experience of people coming off dialysis. So when you read One of the Body's Many Cries for Water, I've just touched on some of the areas that he goes into detail. Now, I did mention that when the body doesn't have enough water, it goes into a form of drought management. Now, the hormone that it releases to help manage the drought in the body is called histamine. So when a person's dehydrated, their histamine levels rise, because histamine is what is used by the body for the drought management. And so when someone's histamine levels are high, what's the reaction in the body?
Allergies.
So this gets us back once again. When someone has an allergy, it may be due to dehydration, or it may be due to an allergy to the five allergen foods, or it may be they're living in a mouldy house, or it may be that they've got a lot of exposure to chemicals. That's why in case of sickness, what's the first thing you do? Ascertain the cause. And do you remember Dr. Batman Gehaldi's other two titles to his book? He's not sick, he's thirsty. Don't treat thirst with medication. The only time exercise doesn't work is if you don't drink before exercise. And at Misty Mountain Health Retreat, we do an exercise program in the morning. So the first thing our guests do, we encourage them to take water to their room. We encourage them to try and drink a glass of water before they come into the health centre in the morning. When I say the health centre, we have rooms in our health centre, but some of our guests are staying out in other dwellings. So ideally we ask our guests to drink at least one glass of water before they come into the area where our exercise coordinator has a whole row of aloe water. Remember we talked about the aloe water with the squares of lemon? So if they have a glass of water in their room and then the glass of aloe water, then when they're doing their exercise, they've had a quarter of their daily quota of water before 6:30 in the morning. So when you explain it like that, it becomes very reachable. So when I worked as a psychiatric nurse, we always had the social workers. And what the social workers did is they would come in and they would look at where the person's going home, they'd look at the situation at home, and do they need help, do they need care at home, do they need, you know, how can we implement this at home? So as medical missionaries, I believe we also need to be social workers and showing people how they can drink water, showing people how they can implement this into their daily lives. And what you'll find is often you get resistance. And so when you get resistance, then you say, well, would you do this? Well, would you do that? And I remember one day I had this girl, and this girl had anorexia. Anorexia is when they think they're really big and they just stop eating. And she was with us all week. And when I first consulted with her, I was intrigued. How did this happen? She was there with her mother. The mother said, we came back from holidays and she'd started. And I said, where did all this start? And then she admitted where her mother was away, she'd gone to a site on the computer on anorexia, and she'd started watching it. And what happened was the thought started to go into her mind. The thought. We have to be so careful on what goes into our minds, don't we? And it's very difficult today with the computer, because so quickly can children be taken in. If adults find it hard, how hard is it for children? So she had this in her mind. Now, she was the same size as me, but she wanted to get down to 45 kilos. And I said, well, quite possibly on the juicing day you might come down. Well, she didn't. So she was even more upset. And she would not eat breakfast. She would only eat lunch. And I had a lot of trouble getting her to drink water. But what I appealed to her was, you won't be as hungry if you drink water. So she started to drink a little bit more water. The mother was beside herself because she didn't know what to do. And you never nag, because it never does any good. And sometimes it can alienate you from the person. So I did get her to drink water, which is something she was not doing. And when I had the final consultation with her, I was trying to find something that she would have for breakfast, because she would only eat one meal a day. So I'd say, would you do this? No. 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 I said, well, what would you do? So then you ask them. And she said, well, I only want to eat one meal a day. And I said, but what if a little bit down the track you might consider eating breakfast? Let's put a breakfast together just in case further down the track you might eat breakfast. And so in that way we got out of her something that she would eat. But the good news is that on Saturday morning, when I talked on the mind, when I talked about the reason, intellect and judgment, and the interaction that part of the brain has with our thoughts and our feelings, praise be to God, something clicked in her mind. Something clicked. Don't we praise God the way he can work? You don't know whether some of the things you're saying. And then Sunday morning she got up and she had breakfast with us. That was huge. Absolutely huge. And then she emailed me 3 weeks later. She said, I'm happy with my body. That's huge. She said, I'm having breakfast every day. Praise be to God. Because anorexia, I don't know if you've ever dealt with that. You might have people come to you that. That's very difficult. But it's important to know that it is a mental illness. You know, that everything we do in our body starts here. It starts in our mind. And that's why it's so important to pray for your guests and to pray for wisdom for each one of them. And the more difficult they are, the more you pray. And you don't know, but God knows. He knows the words that will touch their heart. So when they went home, the mother was crying. She was so happy. She was so happy. But it happened right near the end. So as we're going through the program, we're thinking, oh, what else can we do? What else can we do? So that's why prayer is a very important part of our health centers. I'm going to move into exercise now because I've got 1 hour for exercise, but it's going to take a little bit longer, so I'm going to do a little bit now. Yes?
What about the pH value?
The pH value?
Yeah, drinking water.
Yes, you might have heard a lot of alkaline water, have you?
Yeah.
In fact, it'll cost you a lot of money. I think I know in Australia it's about $8,000 for an alkaline water machine. And do we need alkaline water? Alkaline water is great, and there are some reports. I think it's in Japan. They've been using it in surgery with great results. But as you saw in the acid alkaline lecture, what affects it most is the laws. Do you remember we went through the laws that pure air alkalizes, sunshine alkalizes, all the no list, create an acid condition, early nights alkalize, just the right amount of exercise alkalizes. Proper diet does, meaning lots of fruits and vegetables, more alkaline foods. That has the most effect on the acid alkaline balance in your body. And it is true that most water is slightly acid because of chlorine and because of fluoride. But you can alkalize your water with a squeeze of lemon. That can help to alkalize the water. If you have an alkaline water machine, it certainly is. It will not hurt to drink it, won't hurt it at all. In fact, it is of benefit. That is true. But never drink it with your meal, because the alkaline water will help to negate very much your acid stomach. So I believe that you are far better to concentrate on alkalizing your body through the eight laws, and particularly the food you're eating, rather than spend a lot of money on the alkaline water machine. But if you have an alkaline water machine, enjoy. It certainly can help. But one lady said to me, "Barbara, my husband and my family, we like a bit of junk food." She said, "We're always going to eat a little bit, so we've got the alkaline water machine to help." I don't know whether it'll help that much. Yes?
About water, one more question. Honey in water, is that the same as having sugar in it?
A little bit.
A little bit.
A little bit.
And agave syrup as well.
Yeah, yeah. You're best to train yourself out of the sweetening of the drinks, I believe. Yeah?
What about structured water?
What is structured water?
Structured water is the water that they claim is what the pure water that you get from waterfalls, for example, and that there are machines that can structure the water back into the form that we had before it came into.
This is a very interesting question. With waterfalls, do you know what the falling water is doing? It's oxygenating the water.
Mm-hmm.
And you can oxygenate your water. Do you want me to show you how?
Mm-hmm.
Get a glass of water and an empty glass and pour it backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and drink it. It's that falling water. Remember your... So obviously we need to drink the purest water possible, and many taps should be should have filters on them. And we have beautiful water at Misty Mountain, and we have a filter, an ultraviolet filter, in our health centre, but in all our homes we don't have it. I don't filter the water that we drink. Yes?
I've heard that so many Adventist doctors drink distilled water.
Mm-hmm.
Is the greatest or necessary?
I don't believe it's necessary to drink distilled water. We just drink the water we get at Misty Mountain. Some say you really shouldn't drink distilled water because you're not getting the minerals. How many minerals are in water? Not much. Not much. But it can be helpful to drink distilled water when you're on a detox, because the emptier the water, the more waste it can take out of you. That's really the only reason that I see. So let us move on to body movement. God designed that this living machinery it be in daily activity, and that in that activity is its preserving power. So what's a preservative? something that stops you going bad or off. Is that right? And I find that when I meet people in their latter years who are in good working condition, I already know they're exercising. And we had a young couple do our program. She was 78 and he was 82. And this couple was vibrant. And then I discovered they swim 2 kilometres in the sea every single morning.
Wow.
I said, no wonder you guys look good. They said, you should see us on the dance floor. They're not adverse, but 78 and 82. Do you know, it was interesting. They were with us for 2 weeks, and mid 2 weeks, they both made a decision to stop their blood pressure medication and their cholesterol lowering and their blood thinners. Oh, they just came alive. A lot of people come to the retreat and choose to start dropping their medication there so that, you know, that you can keep an eye on them. But again, if they, and I think I gave stories earlier, if there's a big reaction, go back on the meds or go back on half meds, you know. And then, but what if the person is, but I want to come off them? I said, yes, that's a good idea, but go a bit slower. Do it over a longer period of time. And I had one guy he was from England. He had a stroke and he had the stroke at the top of stairs. He was about 78 and he'd fallen down the stairs. And he had no ability to move his right side. He built it up a little bit, but what he did was he'd walk like this. And if you ever tried to help him, he'd go, no, I can do it myself, I'll do it myself. And we'd say, would you like us to give you a lift down to the steam bath? Because from the health centre, the steam baths, you know, say the turn on the road up there. No, I'm walking. And when he was trying to get dressed, you'd go to help him. No, I do it myself, I'm doing it myself. I actually think that's why he'd come so far. And he was on quite a bit of medication. He was with us for 2 weeks. Mid 2 weeks, he came to me with the medication in a bag. He said, I'm just going to throw it all in the bin. He said, I'm sick of it. And I said, hang on a minute. You've got medication there for depression and for panic attack? He said, I don't even know why they've got me on it. He said, I've never had a panic attack and I don't know. I've never been depressed. I don't know why they've got me on it. So a guy that was working for us at the time was a chemist. So I said, Andrew, come and have a look at this medication. He wants to stop it. And he looked at it and he said, he looked at the man, he said, do it. And that man never looked back. And I think it's because, you know, the old saying, where there's a will, there's a way. He just said, I'm done with it. He said, it's just so hard. I was so vulnerable that, you know, and that, the hospital and the doctors, they probably saved my life. And I'm very grateful for that. And they certainly got me up and running. But he said, not now. He said, I'm done with it. And I think that he did not have any effect because he just made up his mind. Yeah. So the mind is quite an incredible piece of machinery. So what I'd like to look at is, what type of exercise is the most effective?
Okay.
Because there are many forms of exercise, and you hear lots of forms of exercises. And what we find is, and the research is also showing this, that the high-intensity interval training, and we've referred to it a couple of times this week, the high-intensity interval training is basically, as the name implies, intervals of high intensity, intervals of recovery, and it's usually done for a cycle. So the first documented case of the high-intensity interval training was from a Japanese physiologist named Tabata. And Tabata was a trainer, and his trainees were figure skaters, and they were figure skating champions. And he implemented interval training. There's a little bit of documentation about it before the war. Apparently Germany was doing it a little bit, but then the war hit and so much was lost. So what he did was he got them to do 20 seconds of high intensity. He got them to do a 60-second recovery time, and he got them to do this for a cycle. What he found was when it came time for the event, they had an edge. And Dr. Doug McGuff, in his book, Body by Science, he also looks at the interval training. He says 30 seconds, 90 seconds recovery, and also for a cycle of six. So what's the maths on that? Let's be generous. What's that, 15 minutes a day? So we've got no excuse not to exercise. How many people don't exercise because they don't have time? So if someone says they don't have time to do this, you know what I say? It's time to do an assessment of what you do with your time. How much time do you spend on the computer? How much time do you spend on the phone? How much time do you spend on Facebook? WhatsApps? Do an assessment of your time. In the book Christ Objects Lesson, on the chapter of talents, Ellen White says there is one talent that we will be held more accountable than any other talent. It is the talent of time. Time. I came to love time, value time, and use time as a mother with so many children, and some of them in school and no electricity. I use time. And I was able to get so much in the day just keeping to time.
How about the warm-up?
Pardon?
Can you do high-intensity training without warming up the muscles?
Ideally, you should warm up. Ideally, you should. Now, what Michael and I do, and you probably know that most of your stretching should be done after you're warmed up, so you don't want to do too many stretches to begin with. But I think the stretch of just stretching out your hamstrings, which basically is this one, I think that's a good one, especially when we've been laying in bed all night. Mm-hmm. And what our exercise coordinator does, he gets the guests to hit themselves. Mm-hmm. Oh, they laugh and giggle, they're hitting themselves all over. Mm-hmm. And also just shaking your limbs. So a little bit of a warm-up is a good idea. Much depends on what you're going to do for your high intensity. So what Michael and I do is we walk. And our first part of our exercise is walking, and we walk down a slight hill, probably a little bit like the one out here. And I have my bag with my towel in it for my dunk, and I put it on the side of the road where my stairs are down to the creek. And then, so after we've walked for maybe 5 minutes, and then we do our first high intensity up the hill. So looking at where you're going to do it, and all depending what you do for your high intensity, the warm-up is important. If you're rebounding, your warm-up may be just, remember I said this is the health bounce? So you don't jump on the rebounder and start leaping wildly. You do a bit of warm-up. And remember Howard with his hitting of the muscles. So ideally there is a little bit of a warm-up when you're going into that. Most of the research of this high-intensity interval training has been done on the exercise bike. The exercise bike is excellent for people who have hip, knee or ankle problems because all their weight is on the seat, or most of their weight's on the seat. And also if the balance isn't good, they're holding on to the handlebars and they can go very, very fast and do their high intensity, and when they get to the recovery time, then slow. So with Michael and I, we run up the hill and then we walk down another hill, and then there's another rise. So we've got this because we live up in the hills, and there's quite nice hills here. I'm not running at the moment because a week ago I had a very, very sore back, and I tried this morning because it's so much better, and it said no. So I've just got to wait a little bit longer before I can run up the hills. But remember, it's not the odd day you do it or the odd day you don't. It's what you do every day. And because I have been doing this for many years, my body can cope with not doing it hard and fast for a little while. And when I dive in the water, when I first came here and started the breaststroke, back didn't like that, so I went on my back for a while. Well, this morning I did breaststroke and there was no pain at all.
Hmm.
I'm very impatient, but it does take time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I do have to realise that I have some past injuries on my lower back. I manage them and I think I manage them quite well, but when I have to sit on a plane, and when I was going from Scotland to Manchester, I got in the bus at 9 a.m, hour on the bus and then on the train and then another train and then, you know, crammed in, so back wasn't very happy with all of that. So you have a look at that and you understand why these things are happening, and just thank God every day for his healing powers. So it might be swimming, your high intensity. It might be push-ups, your high intensity. So it's whatever works for you. And it certainly is different for different people. What's your recovery? The research shows that even though you might feel like sitting down because you've been running so fast or going so fast, your recovery time is much better if it's just doing something. So your recovery might be just stretching. Stretch the legs. Or it might be just... So you might be resting the legs that have been going fast and work out on the top. So just doing a little bit is better than doing nothing. Your fitness is not determined by how hard and fast you go, but how long you take to recover. Dr. Al Sees in his book Pace, he gives the story of a lady who did 7 seconds high intensity and needed 15 minutes to recover. Now, I often tell that story because not many people are that unfit. Now, you know what happens the next day? She might do 8 seconds and have 12 minutes recovery. Can you see that?
Mm-hmm.
That's why the word pace, the first word is progressive. This is progressive. What you can't do now, little by little every day you can do it. But what I'm thankful for, and I really wanted to show our couple here before the break, what happens inside the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very happy to Doug McGough for showing in detail what happens in the cell. So let me very quickly draw this. And we know it very well now, don't we? We've got the 20-step pathway, and how much energy does it give?
Two.
And the end result of the 20-step pathway is a chemical form called pyruvate. And pyruvate is the chemical form of glucose that gets fed into the powerhouse. This 8-step pathway is able to give us how much energy? 36 units of energy. Over on the side, remember our glycogen stores, our quick-release glucose stores? Just sitting there in the muscle cell, waiting to be used if you run out of fuel. And if you're doing it early in the morning, you're going to run out of fuel real quick because you haven't eaten since the day before. And then we've got our fat cells, the most amazing storage unit in the human body. And that's what fat is, excess glucose stored. I also told you that this 20-step pathway, remember it's the anaerobic pathway, that's no oxygen. It's fast. It consumes a lot of glucose. The 8-step pathway is slow. And remember, that's your oxygen pathway. So let me show you what's happening here. 30 seconds high intensity. By the end of the 30 seconds, you are running out of fuel. It is early morning. And so what happens is the glucose molecules start to be plucked down the pathway, amazing process. But what's starting to happen is the 20 step speeds up, the 8 step speeds up, and there's a rate setting enzyme in there that will always make this one faster and always keep this one slower. So more pyruvate is being made than can be fed into the powerhouse, and so it's stored as lactic acid. You've heard of lactic acid? But what's incredible is that in recovery time, when you're having a little bit of a rest, it's when we walk down the hill, your lactic acid is converted back into pyruvate and fed into the powerhouse. So two things are happening there. When you're in recovery time, your lactic acid is being mopped up. Mm-hmm. And when you're in recovery time, you're burning just as much fuel as when you're running for your life. What an amazing body. Mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons why this is such a powerful form of exercise. Let's go to the second set of high intensity. We're certainly using up our glycogen stores. Let's go to the third or fourth set. Glycogen stores have run out. Where are we going to get our fuel from now? Now the brain speaks to the pituitary gland, which releases the human growth hormone. And the human growth hormone is very active when we're growing. When we stop growing, it goes into retirement. The human growth hormone, once it's released, triggers a release of hormone-sensitive lipase. Now, yesterday we looked at the enzymes breaking down our food. We looked at sublingual lipase under the tongue. What does it break down? Saturated fat. We looked at pancreatic lipase that breaks down our polyunsaturated fats. So what does this lipase break down? What does hormone-sensitive lipase break down? Which fat? Fat. Remember, we're running out of fuel. What's fat? Stored fuel. So the pituitary gland releases releases the human growth hormone, which triggers a release of hormone-sensitive lipase. It's all designed to give us more fuel. Then the human growth hormone causes the body to stop burning glucose as fuel and become a fat burner. Why? Because glucose burns, do you remember, at 4 calories per gram. Do you remember what fat burns at?
9.
Fat burns at 9 calories per gram. So when the body starts burning fat as fuel, it's going to give more than twice the units of energy that glucose will give. Can you see the process? There's more. There's more. How could it get better than that? It does. It does. We were fearfully and we were wonderfully made. The human growth hormone increases the body's ability to utilize protein. We've looked at the importance of protein this week, the importance of eating sufficient protein, the importance of not drinking with our meals so we can break down that protein. Now we look at the high-intensity interval training causes a release of the human growth hormone, which increases the body's ability to utilize protein. There's more. The human growth hormone increases the circulation of the blood to the skin. That slows down aging. So the young couple, the 78-year-old and the 82-year-old, 78 was the lady and 82 was the man. The skin on their face was smooth. Now, yes, they had wrinkles, and you're allowed to have wrinkles when you're in the 70s and 80s, but their face looked good. I've met people in their mid-60s and they're so lined. Now, I do understand there's a bit of a genetic thing. I know that the majority of people with dark skin, they don't seem to develop the wrinkles as quickly as the white-skinned people. That's certainly true. The movie stars pay $1,000 a week for this, and I'm offering you cut price today. 15 minutes a day.
Thank you.
High intensity interval training causes a release of the human growth hormone, which stays active for 24 hours. God's work suffers because his people are sick.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons they're sick is because they're not training efficiently and effectively for his work.
Yeah.
And what's one of the training? It's exercise. I started exercising about 18 years ago now. I didn't used to. I just thought, oh, I'm okay, I'm busy all day, I'm digging in the garden, I'm running up here, I'm doing this. But a situation happened that showed me that I was not fit. So I began. And I exercised for 3 years. And then one morning Michael said, I'm going to join you today. You never nag, because it never does any good. I've got some exciting news. Even though I'm not with him now, he exercises every morning. And Ellen White says in the book Counsel on Health, I think it's about page 56, in a short time you will so realise the benefits of pure air and exercise, you would not live without these blessings.